The first cell phone was demonstrated in 1973 by Martin Cooper. You know what wasn't demonstrated? Shared plans. Over 50 years later, you can save on one line thanks to Visible. When you switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless Visible, you can get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees. No, really. You can look around for them. They're not there. Switch now at Visible.com. Save on wireless without the hassle. Switch to Visible today and save at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Beyond and hello and welcome to IGN's weekly PlayStation show, episode 817. I think last week I said we were 300 episodes earlier. I was wrong. Anyway, I'm Max Scoville and I'm joined today by Jada Griffin, Ryan Altano, and Matt Kim. Hello, everybody.
Just like to practice your time travel, Max. That's all.
Yes.
You're time traveling.
I don't know. I feel like maybe being on episode 500 would make me feel like a little bit, you know, maybe 6 years younger, like a little bit more sprightly, a little more spring in my step. But, a girl can dream. Now let's get into this. We got a lot of stuff to talk about. Matt, you just reviewed Cyberpunk Phantom Liberty, which is very cool. It's more cyberpunk in the best of ways. But before we get to that, there's actually some real life cyberpunk things going on in our friendly neighborhood dystopia. It seems like Sony may have been hacked again. Possibly there is a ransomware group that is claiming to have hacked Sony. They say that they successfully compromised all Sony systems. They didn't run a spell check on their ransom letter, but they, I feel like, ransom letters are supposed to have like little backwards letters, supposed to cut it up out of newspaper clippings a little bit,
They couldn't find the extra E in there. It's fine.
Yeah.
They were just trying to cut it out of the magazine.
Isn't compromised though, like an extra S?
They went out of their way. They put an extra S in there. What could it
be? They wanted to know that they're super serious.
Anyway, but super seriously, just for the sake of cautionary tale, like anybody out there, if you're listening to this show, I'm assuming you have a PSN account. It probably wouldn't hurt to update your password. Sony hasn't actually, like, it doesn't sound like they've verified this is a big thing or not, but it's not like Sony got on the horn and said, hey everybody, our stuff got hacked again, oops, our bad. This was some people on a dark web forum being like, we have hacked Sony, we have their JPEGs and their PDFs to prove it. And I don't know where this is going to go, but
Said that they tried to sell the data back to Sony and Sony was like, no, we don't want it, probably because they already have it or whatever. And then these guys were like,
we don't need to.
Oh, yeah, well, then we're going to step three, step four, profit or whatever. It's like the underwear thing from South Park. But I immediately went to go change my password. And that was fun because like when you try to do that on the PlayStation website, you get this like weird captcha, and mine at first was like, identify all the motorcycles. And it was like one motorcycle that looked like it had fallen asleep in a bunch of towels. I didn't understand. I don't know if it was like AI generated. And the next thing was, it was a picture of somebody doing two fingers. And then there was a frog and you had to rotate the frog, so he was facing the same direction as the two fingers. And I was like,
I love that one.
I think I got a good deer. Yeah. I think I got like a deer or a doe or something for that one.
Yeah, it was like it was a weird panic thing, and also have to like finger the frog to figure out how to change my.
Don't I
was like,
say that.
Brian, you texted me a screenshot of that, and I was really confused because like it was it was like 6:30 in the morning or whatever, and our friend was like, "Oh, could everyone change your passwords? Get on that." And you're like, "I'll get right on that after I'm done fingering this frog's beehole." I thought you were playing some Switch game or something. Like I don't know.
Yeah, Nintendo lets anything on the eShop now.
Yeah, I don't know. Some hot new indie.
It's one of those. It's one of those. What is it? Touch the Mayo, the one everyone was getting all the platinum trophies on.
That was the Max played it. It was Stroke the Parrot.
Yeah, cool. That was a game.
Well, Finger the Frog is available on PSN right now. Right now, there's no trophies. It's super easy to beat. I know you guys.
Doesn't even cost
games.
Anything.
Yeah, free to play. I would honestly love an indie game that's just like a WarioWare full of captchas. Like I feel like there's an entire aesthetic that goes with that, and like someone's gonna jump on that at some point and make something very weird. But
don't know. It's a nice little art form in and of itself.
Yeah, change the password. If you see the frog, you know, tweet at us. Show us the frog. Show us where you put the fingers.
Yeah. Go do stuff to the frog and change your password, and everyone will have a great time, and the security will be saved, I guess. Anyway, that was our serious news part. Let's talk about Cyberpunk 2077 Phantom Liberty, a gigantic kick-ass expansion to a gigantic, finally kick-ass game. I feel like this is a funny situation because CDPR, in addition to putting out like the big, huge, here's the new content, they also dropped Update 2.0, which was really tweaking a lot of old content and really going back and adjusting a lot of the stuff that kind of the game already was. And it's, I'm trying to think of the last time a company has done this, you know, like typically it's kind of funny because I keep sort of, I mean, I'm playing sort of Baldur's Gate in parallel, and I feel like it's a little bit like when a game comes out of early access and gets a bunch of new stuff on top of what was already there. And that early adopters are familiar with, and they're like, we've changed a bunch of stuff, there's a bunch of new stuff too. But in this case, they're like, yeah, we added, you know, like a car hacking and totally new skill trees and all sorts of new stuff. And it's if you're jumping back into it alongside the expansion, it's kind of hard to keep track of what, you know, what's for the sake of the expansion and what's something that just people got for free. Matt, you can speak to this better than I can. You reviewed it, you gave it a 9 out of 10, the expansion, not the update. I don't think we review updates yet, but yeah, tell us about it.
I did review it, and just briefly touch on it, the 2.0 thing, the biggest change for people who just want like a TLDR for it is like the skill tree has been like completely revamped for the game. So like it doesn't matter if you have Phantom Liberty or not, like you have a new skill tree, and it just makes more sense. I remember when the game first came out and I was just putting points into skill trees being like, I think this maybe does what I want it to, but then maybe it won't, so who's to say? And then this one is just like, you want to be a hacker, put your skills in here. You want to be a big strong guy, put your skills in here. You want to do stealth, you know, it's just way more clear cut, and it's way easier to mess around and create a build that like suits you, and like it's, and you can respec at any time, which totally makes sense in universe, right? Because you're a half android robot thing, you should be allowed to change your skills and abilities whenever you want, so it's great. And then they also added shooting out of a car, a thing that I have not used a single time since it's come out. I just they tell you can have vehicle combat, and I just have not used it. I was kind of expecting it to show up at some point, and it's fine. But Phantom Liberty is completely separate, and you do have to pay for that one, and it's a like separate story. But it's like they do that Dark Souls thing, and I guess technically The Witcher 3 also did it, but they do it where you just like, they just like insert it into the main game, and at a certain point it just unlocks for you, and so you just like get a phone call, they'll be like, hey, come check out this weird thing in Dogtown, and that is your cue to like enter this entire like 20 hour DLC, which was CDPR says it's a spy story. And at first when I heard that, I was like, why is it a spies and cyberpunk? I'm not really sure how that goes hand in hand, but it absolutely works. Like it's great. The president of the NUSA, which you have to look up if you're not familiar with the tabletop RPG, crash lands into Dogtown, which is a independent neighborhood within Night City, which is in and of itself an independent city in America. It's all very convoluted, but very cool. And the president like crash lands in there, and then the secret agent who is their detail finds you, and he's like, hey, V, are you ready to save the president of America, of the NUSA? And you're just like, yeah, sure, okay, cool.
Are you a bad enough dude?
Are you a bad enough dude to save the president?
Are you a sneak enough Pliskin to do some sneaking and Pliskin?
Yeah, like it's 100% escape from New York. You know,
and
very
the escape from LA basketball scene too, which is
great. It's awesome. A lot of that, you know, like secret, and you know, it's a spy story, right? So like, it's not a spoiler to say there's going to be double crossings and like weird allegiances, and you never really know who to trust at the end of the day. And I wasn't really sure how they were going to pull it off, and by the end of it, I was like, that was pretty amazing. Idris Elba goes a long way to because he's big spy, he's Solid Snake in this universe, and his performance is like one of those things where you like really want to trust him at all times, but you also know that he's the number one spy in Cyberpunk, and so you're always just sort of in the back of your mind being like, I want to trust you, like I really do, and you're really convincing, and you're really cool, Idris Elba, but like, can I? And you know, that's a question that is going to you know, that's gonna haunt you.
How do you learn that he's the number one spy? Does he wear a shirt? Like, does he like go around yelling it like Archer?
He has a little trophy he carries.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's the first thing he shows you when you meet him.
He just
in the
jumps
game.
Out and just like scares you a lot. You don't see him.
Yeah, you're like, ah.
No, he's like, his performance is fantastic. His character model is just him with some cyberware. And like, it was like the first time you get in a car with him, he's driving around and I found myself like, he was talking to me and I just turned the camera and I was just looking at him the whole time. And I'm like, oh, this is so cool. I'm sitting in the car with Idris Elba. And I was like, oh yeah, I should probably look around this whole awesome city that they built and like all these new areas and it's beautiful and gorgeous. And they added all this new fresh coat of paint, but I'm sitting there and I'm like, yeah, but I'm in a car with Idris Elba from The Wire. This rules.
It's all like secondary to Idris Elba. You don't look at any. If you're in a car with Idris Elba, you don't look at anything but Idris Elba, Brian.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's why that lion kept trying to get in his car in that movie about the lion.
I think it's a really cool fit that they got him for this, because in this sort of in the same way that like Keanu has this cyberpunk, you know, repertoire of like, you know, he was in Johnny Mnemonic and The Matrix, and he's just like a good fit for Johnny Silverhand. Like, it kind of makes sense, even if it is a little distracting that it's Keanu. In this case, like, Idris in a lot of people's heads is like, yeah, he would be a killer James Bond. And he's like, I'm not going to be James Bond. I'm not, you know, that's fine. But, you know, he's kind of moved on from that idea. And this is kind of letting him be, you know, letting him be James Bond in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really cool.
But yeah, Matt, tell us about some of the sort of the new, I guess, the new additions. Like, what does this bring to the story aside from like a story? I mean, what are the kind of what does this expand upon?
So, okay. So the main thing is that if you get this expansion, you'll just have a straight up new area to explore called Dogtown. And it's one of those things where, like, regardless of, you know, the whether you liked it or not, I think we all agree that like Night City might be one of the best video game locations in the last like 10 years. Like, it's, no one has made an open world quite like it. And Dogtown just adds a whole new area with a bunch of new side quests and a bunch of like extra things to do and to explore and just to appreciate. And it's like, that's the main thing that you get with this expansion. There are like specific items and weapons and clothes that you can get, but they're kind of like not why you would spend $30 on an expansion, right? Like, but having a whole new area to explore in Night City is a pretty good reason. Plus, also, honestly, it's just the story, which is really good.
How are the side quests? Because I feel like, you know, the story is always pretty solid in CDPR, but the side quests are just like the best.
Yeah, I feel like they went back, found what works and what doesn't work in the original game, and then just sort of like narrowed in on like the good stuff. And so you do the same thing where there's a fixer who oversees Dogtown, and he's like, hey, V, I've got a job for you. Can you help out these, you know, two dumb cops escape this gangster? Or can you help rescue this arms dealer or something like that? And so that's sort of the thing that they, you know, it's in the base game too, but it's here too. But one thing that I really liked is, I feel like, not all of them, but I feel like most of these missions end with like a big decision that can impact how the story plays out afterwards. There's kind of like always an epilogue, and it always sort of depends on what A, B route you choose at the
end. You told me about like the dumb cop one. I don't want to spoil the choices and stuff, but I was like halfway through it. Like, I did like one step of the mission, and you were like, oh dude, that one's got a killer ending. And I don't think it had a killer ending. I think I might have screwed something up and I got the bad ending.
Yeah, I mean,
the ending I got involved a bunch of hot dogs. I don't know if that's the one that you got. Did you get the hot dog ending? Because I got
that
the
hot
dog.
Like a perfect ending for you, Max. You love hot dogs.
I personally like it, but I was expecting something a little bit more convoluted. You know, I don't know.
So that's the ending. My favorite part of that was actually like the final face-off in the garage, and that can play out like three different ways.
Okay, yeah,
and that's what I had the best time with.
Okay, that was pretty cool. Yeah, I mean, it's funny because, and I always forget this about sort of how, you know, CDPR approaches this, and this is when I think it's like it's hammering hardest on being like a proper role-playing game where you can fail something and then proceed. And like, you can fail a side quest, and there's something that's so frustrating about that when it's not like, you know, it's not like you shoot the wrong person, or it's not like you just die during the mission. It's like you just say the wrong thing, and then someone's like, well, I say good day to you, and they go along, and it's like you fail this mission. Like, there's one where you have to basically, you have to convince this like celebrity to come help you with something. And, you know, there's one way where you can be like,
hey, I can make you rich. I got a great new deal. I got an offer. You'd be great for the part.
Or you could be like, hey, my friend really needs some help. Will you come help? And she's like, I'm not a nun. I'm not going to help you. Get out of here. And then it's just like, you failed. And I was like, oh, I tried to appeal to her better sense. And then I went back and looked, and there's basically, you get a text message from somebody who gives you like sort of a kind of characterizes her. And it's like, hey, she loves money. She's kind of a jerk, you know? And it's like, had I read that in advance, it would have been very clearly like, oh, that's not the right course of action to take. But mm-hmm. I don't know. I love that kind of stuff. Again, I want to have a larger conversation about this when I've fully finished Phantom Liberty and probably taken a bigger chunk out of Baldur's Gate. But like, I'm comparing the two because they both came out right next to each other. They're both based on tabletop games. They are mm-hmm. both massive sprawling things that have effectively had, 3 years respectively to figure their stuff out, but they're both doing something completely different. And I think it's kind of a hard adjustment. Because like there's obviously like some very deep role-playing systems in Cyberpunk, but at the same time, there's also some very, there's some Far Cry, like there's some GTA, like there's some much more surface level experiences. And there's also, I feel like a much more, you know, maybe there's a more sort of cinematic stylized story, but it's a lot more kind of walled off. Like there's things that the game really wants to tell you, whereas Baldur's Gate is kind of like, what do you want to do? What do you want to do here? You can do whatever mm-hmm. you want. Like, I feel like Cyberpunk is very much F around, and Baldur's Gate is very much find out. And it's like, you know, that's the best way I could put it. And it's been an adjustment. And I remember this is like I remember having a similar feeling going from playing Fallout 3 into Red Dead Redemption a million years ago mm-hmm. and just being weirdly frustrated that you couldn't pick up everything in the game. And like, that's not a fair complaint by a long shot. And like, they're both phenomenal open world games doing entirely different things. They both have a lot of dusty, dirty stuff everywhere. They're both kind of old timey. But it's, you know, those are totally different games. But in this case, like Baldur's Gate and Cyberpunk are like, there's a lot of similar DNA there. And it's just kind of bizarre to sort of see how they've deviated. And it's, I don't know, I guess it's also my play style has been, I think, more experimental this time around. Like when I played Cyberpunk the mm-hmm. first time, I was like, yeah, I'll do some stealthy Far Cry stuff. I'll shoot some people. I'll try to be sneaky. I didn't really bother with hacking too much, like a tiny bit. And this time I'm pumping all of my points into intelligence and what technical facility or whatever it's called. And just messing with quick hacks and trying to just kind of walk in and not even draw a gun. Just fry everybody on the spot. And it's an interesting experience because it's still very combat forward. Mm-hmm. But it feels, in that sense, it feels almost kind of puzzly. Like it feels a little bit like Hitman-ish, where you're kind of setting a bunch mm-hmm. of things into action.
Right.
But then if you screw up, like if it kind of backfires, it just goes full action. There's not really like a, you know, there are options to sort of like, oh, like you can get out of discovery. I feel like it's a much more pass-fail approach to stealth. I mean, it's not pass-fail because you can weasel your way out of a situation, but like once you're discovered, just it's kind of all systems blaring and everyone's just shooting at you. And it's sort of like, okay, well now I just shoot people in the head.
So I haven't messed around in the expansion or the 2.0 yet, but I've heard that the hacking and net running stuff is actually harder to do, like / worse, just because of like your RAM overheats and doesn't regenerate as fast, apparently, with the updates. I haven't tested this myself, but I've just going on comments I've read and, you know, all of our pieces, our review and stuff like that. That's what it sounded like. Cause that's how I played the first playthrough, Max, how you're describing. It's like, I went full netrunner, full hacking. I was just triggering cyber psychosis and everybody in the battle, and they were just fighting. They would kill each other. And then I would just walk up and kill whoever was left. Matt, or any of you guys have you guys noticed any kind of difference in that?
No. So one of the things I think is that maybe it might be because it's a departure from pre 2.0, but like in order to not overheat your RAM or overclock yourself, that's all in the new skill tree, and which is easy to find, right? And so you'll find parts in your skill tree that's like, this is where you overclock. And it's also, they've done away with stats in clothing. And so now it's all in your, what's it called, cybernetics or whatever they call it in universe. And so you go, in order to like increase your RAM, you go to a Ripper dock and you buy more RAM, and it's very like straightforward in that sense. Like it makes more sense, I think, right? It's like, it used to be, how do you get more RAM? And the set game was kind of like, maybe if you do some of these things. But now it's very much like, how do I get more RAM? I either increase my intelligence stats or I go to a Ripper Dock and buy more.
I like it a lot better as opposed to being like, these pants make you smarter. It's like,
yeah, I'm so glad they got rid of that. I'm actually pretty over that in most games because I'd just much rather wear the cool stuff I want to wear and then worry about stats elsewhere. Like it's, you know, like I find myself in a lot of games, like I'll like just end up in one costume for the entire game because of stat reasons. Like Liza P did a cool thing, the same deal where it was just like, oh, your costumes don't really have an effect on your stats. Your weapons do, but like, you know, wear the donkey mask for 25 hours. Who cares?
Yeah.
And I dig that. Yeah. It's like, it's interesting because it's like, I'm, and again, like that's what's kind of awesome about this game is I'm playing it just straight up like guns out action game shooter, blow stuff up, shoot people in the head, like getting little perks and rewards for headshots and like using weapons a certain way in a certain amount of time. And I'm you know, switching out guns for better ones. And like, you know, there's some melee stuff I'm doing. But like when I played the base game, which I played literally up until like the final elevator door, like I just didn't go up and then I walked away from the game for a few years. I played that entire game with a katana blade and I was just chopping people up and it was super fun. And this time around, I'm like, let me play it like a shooter. Like, let me, cause that's how I play Far Cry games, right? Like there's a little bit of stealth, but, I was like, let me just run around and shoot stuff. And it's totally working for me. I feel like the like little things that they've tweaked. And, IGN has an awesome video that our guides team put up that was basically like, here's all the updates and here's all the things that are improved in the 2.0 update. Like all the big changes, the driving feels so much better. And it's weird because like I've seen people say it feels more like GTA, which I guess like it feels like the cars have like a little bit of a swing to them. Not so hard as like GTA 4 where like everything kind of felt like very wiggly, but GTA 5, like I feel like they kind of locked in the vehicle controls in that game. And it definitely feels like they lifted a little bit of that here, or at least just like tweaked it in the right direction. Cause like riding around on a motorcycle like feels legitimately good in this game, going like top speed, zipping around a corner and stuff like that, doing like little power slide stuff. Like the guns handle super well. Like there's all that I really, really love. I have like some frustrations with like some of the mission design and some of the stuff that's like sort of built around, like, you know, there's like right now we're looking at a boss fight that happens early on. And there's some like very bizarre checkpointing that happens with that where like he can kind of one hit you or it can one hit you. And then you'll have to restart and go through all the cinematics all over again, which is like a little annoying, but you know, some games like have that push and pull. They don't know exactly where, you know, where to land on that. But I feel like in general, everything here just feels a little bit better. And like, you know, as it should, like this is the game that they said was the game they were making or coming out 3 years ago. And like famously on PlayStation, you couldn't buy Cyberpunk for like a full, what was it, 8 months, a year or something like that. They delisted the game from PSN, which is unheard of. Like we started the show joking about garbage ass games on PSN that people get the trophies in, like, you know, Spank the Mayo or whatever. And like that game's up there forever. It's been up there for like 10 years. Like, you know, and so like I'm glad they did their victory lap. They do get a little kick in the ass for, you know, having to do this to begin with. Like it's, you know, I would rather see a success story where a game goes on and grows and changes. Like Max, at the top of the show, you were kind of talking about like recent examples of games that done this. Obviously No Man's Sky is the big one. Fallout 76 was another one that like was historically just kind of not where people wanted it to be on launch day, and turned around and become one of the biggest successes for Bethesda. Like that's a game that has millions of players actively still. And just, you know, crazy. I bounced off of it, but like Redemption Arc, they found something there. They kept cooking with the right ingredients and they found something. And so like, I don't know, props to them for that. Like, you know, I will scold them for screwing up on launch day, and especially on PlayStation. Like Sony stepped in and was like, no, we're not selling this right now. It's busted as hell.
I mean, Xbox did the same thing. It's wild that was the case. I mean, I have a very complicated relationship with this game. And at the end of the day, I think I like it, but there's like a bunch of other factors at play where like, I don't know. I definitely felt burned by like when it first came out, because the one thing was I had like a brand new PS5 and I was like, hey, cool, finally a big, huge next gen game to play on that. And then you squint a little bit and you're like, wait a second, this is still a PS4 game that's just getting a little boost from, and like, I don't know, there was a sort of sense of buyer's remorse to go with that. And this time around, it has a potentially even distracting use of the DualSense controller. Like, it's kind of wild how much stuff it's doing there. Like if you're like whacking people in the face with a baseball bat, it's like ding dong ding dong dong, like it's just vibrating in your hands. Whenever anybody calls you, they're just like yelling at you through the controller. And I'm like, all right, calm down.
I like that.
You like that?
I also like it
when people call me through the controller, because you know, like anytime, you know, this is another game we're gonna talk about later, but Resident Evil 4, anytime I get a call, like I pick my controller up and put it right next to my ear, like it's a walkie-talkie, like I'm actually like talking to somebody.
You hold it sideways like a Nokia N-Gage or a banana phone. Seriously, you're just like, hello.
Like, I don't even answer my actual phone.
Yeah.
No, because it's weird. I picked the PS4 or the PlayStation version of Cyberpunk to begin with, when, you know, we were all given that choice of which of these busted ass last gen versions of this game are you going to buy on day one? Because I was like, I don't want to play this on PC. I knew this game was going to get updates for years, and I knew like it was going to get a PS5 version eventually. So like I played the long game and I was like, well, eventually like this is going to have a bunch of like really awesome DualSense features. And then fast forward like a year or two into the PlayStation 5's life, and I was like, I'm going to just turn that stuff off. It's annoying me. But no, I'm glad you guys dig it, because that's like, it's literally the reason I bought it on PlayStation to begin with.
Yeah. No, it's funny though, because like I think a lot of it is also expectation and reality. And like I love Cyberpunk, like the genre. Like it's maybe my favorite corner of fiction, pop culture, period. Like I adore it. And I had, you know, a decade plus worth of hype for this game. Like I was it a decade? Yeah, no, it was a lot of time. It was like when they, I got excited about The Witcher because they announced they were making this game. And then The Witcher, you know, story speaks for itself. Understandably, you'd have high expectations after playing The Witcher and then being like, okay, here's their next thing. And if you look at the jump from, you know, The Witcher 2 to The Witcher 3, what's the jump from The Witcher 3 to Cyberpunk? And, you know, fast forward 3 years after launch, I'd say we're around there, but it's still, there's a sort of depth to it that I wish was there. And like, if you approach it as a fast paced action game, if you approach it as a, you know, as a Far Cry, Brian, to your point, like if I had done that, I think I would have had a much better time. But I was hoping for, I don't know what I was hoping. I was hoping for something a little bit, I mean, it's this again, not fair. I found out about Baldur's Gate like a few months ago. Like I think I was hoping for that kind of experience where you can just really, like really get lost in your character. And it's like that is simulating the experience of playing a tabletop game. And I don't think you can fault me for expecting a game based on a tabletop game to try to do that, like Cyberpunk is doing. But at the same time, it also is clearly, you know, it's trying to make itself like relevant. It's trying to be like a, not just for tabletop nerds. Like they want to make something that appeals to more casual gamers too. And I use the word casual very loosely, but I mean the kind of game where you can
more
hold
mainstream,
and somebody.
Not casual, mainstream, but like more mainstream audience. Yeah,
you can drive the people who play Call of Duty and GTA and stuff like that. Like that's not a bad idea to swing for that audience, because that audience is massive and they spend a lot of money on things that they love, and they want to shoot things and blow stuff up. And
this episode of Podcast Beyond is brought to you by NordVPN, a great way to protect yourself online while also improving your overall experience while enjoying cyberspace. Are you tired of streaming shows, movies, or sporting events being unavailable in your region due to draconian restrictions that are based on completely arbitrary geographical boundaries in physical meat space? Well, switch your virtual location to a place where that's no longer an issue. The same goes for shopping. You can get the best possible deal on subscriptions, flights, hotels, and other goods and services like that from websites that like to play favorites with certain territories and currencies. Meanwhile, encrypted traffic protects your data from hackers, viruses, malware, phishing sites, and other harmful hitchhikers of the information superhighway. Though really, it's more of an information autobahn, because there is no speed limit with NordVPN. It is the fastest VPN in the world, so there won't be any buffering or lagging, and it'll stop your ISP from throttling your bandwidth. Isn't that nice? One NordVPN account can be used across 6 devices, which is great. My wife has been using our account to watch all sorts of awful British reality TV shows that aren't available here, like Argument Island or Half Naked Idiots Fall in Love, and everyone's favorite, The Worst People Just Got Married. Let's hear them talk about it. Shows that are so bad they're blocked in our part of the world for our own good, but luckily NordVPN allows her to trick the internet into thinking she's in the UK, so she and her awful friends can shriek and howl and cackle at the TV while I'm trying to relax. I've been using my VPN too. You know what I've been using it for?
None of your business. Yep, that's right. And thanks to NordVPN, my data is safely encrypted, all bundled up in a weighted security blanket of incomprehensibly complex math problems, and nobody can tell what it's doing under there. Data, you do your thing. I'll leave you alone. 1 month of NordVPN coverage costs less than a cup of coffee. Coffee can't protect you from cyber criminals unless you throw it at them or pour it on their computers, and you'll probably get in trouble for doing that. So get NordVPN instead. To get the best possible discount off your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/pobeyond. That link will also give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. There's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Again, that is nordvpn.com/pobeyond. And now, back to the show.
Hey there, it's Rachel Ballinger, and I am thrilled to invite you to Rachel Uncensored, my podcast where I get real with my friends and celebrity guests, where we talk about all sorts of topics. From personal stories to hot button issues, we cover it all. New episodes drop every Wednesday, so make sure you tune in on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss out on the fun and candid conversations we have here on Rachel Uncensored.
I used to kind of also be that audience. I think there was a level where I was like, oh, turn-based, get out of here. I don't want turn-based combat. That's boring. Reading stuff. No, thank you. And it's like, I think that's what appealed so much to me about like Skyrim and Fallout 3 at the time. Like I had a buddy who was super into Fallout 1 and 2, and he also liked 3, but he's like, nah, man, Fallout 2, that's the one you got to do. And I remember just like seeing him play that. And I was like, compared to Fallout 3, get out of here. Are you kidding me? No, thank you. You can't even run around. You can't shoot people in the face in real time. No, thank you. But
grenade in somebody's pocket for it to explode.
Yeah,
taste change.
It's a whole different experience. But yeah, like again, this is on me. These are my expectations of this game, and I'm trying to make peace with it. The other thing is, I'm not going to say dumb cyberpunk, but I want to say it's more on the satirical end than the crunchy hard sci-fi end. And there's hard sci-fi stuff in there. They crib a lot of stuff from William Gibson and Neal Stephenson and all that. But there's also stuff that feels like it's on the cusp of something like Saints Row or Idiocracy, where it's just like it's a lampoon of American culture in a lot of ways. Yes. Which again, cyberpunk has this sort of inherent satirical bent to it. But like I kind of like it from an almost like, I don't know, like this is I like William Gibson's books, the way he writes, it's like walking into a room and picking up everything and looking at it closely. Like there's a certain level of like attention to detail and world building to like the most granular subtle things. And it's about like in this game where you like shoot 15 people and then take all of their machine guns and then break the machine guns down and sell them for parts or whatever. And it's the fact that everyone just has guns constantly. Like I had an 8-year-old girl waving a gun in my face and being like, give me $1,000 and I'll tell you where the power transistor is. And I'm like, okay, here you go. And she's like, I'll tell you where it's near, but I'm not going to tell you where it is. And she's just like just waving a gun around willy nilly. And I'm like, that is kind of a fair assessment of like American culture. That's a little bit over the top, but I'll take it. But again, like it's on me. It's my expectation and I'm trying to have fun with it. There's also stupid things where I want cyberpunk to be a reflection of our existing society. Like there's a Gibson quote, the future's already here, it's just not evenly distributed. In this case, it's kind of a paleofuturism where like this is rooted in a cyberpunk future that was introduced in like 1983 or 5 or whenever Mike Pondsmith created the game. And it's funny because back then like they had to account for smartphones and stuff. But the fact that this is a game where you can't call an Uber or a cab, like there's a whole thing about robot cars in there, but you can't just call a car to come drive you someplace, which is wild to me. And you can't just like pull out your phone and find out where the nearest bus stop is. You have to discover it in person, which is like, that's video gamey stuff. That's like, that's part of the experience. And they don't want you to fast travel everywhere because they want you to experience this incredible world they've built. But on a certain level, I'm like, man, this is really an accurate representation of futuristic dystopian California, where it kind of sucks to drive because of traffic, and it also sucks to take public transit because of infrastructure. And I guess, a robot car would be a nice alternative too. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about one thing about cyberpunk that I feel like will take a couple of years to look back on, but like the reason why cyberpunk happened the way it did in 2020 when it came out was because CDPR kind of set themselves up to fail, right? Like we all remember that 40-minute deep dive video that they publish where they're like, and the clothes you wear will change your interactions. And all of these NPCs have like full day and night cycles and, and all these things. And none of that was in the final game, right? And what that ended up leading to is, I think, like a weird, like, we're now, I feel like, in the most honest time of video game PR that we've been in a long time. CDPR is very upfront about what they're going to do, what their plans are, given that they've already announced a new Witcher game and various studios to work on Witcher spinoffs. And the thing about like studio, like game companies are now being like, hey, we have a live stream tomorrow. Do not expect The Last of Us video game news. We are not going to talk about that. Like, and that's all because of like player expectation got way too high because it was created by like untenable marketing cycles and marketing beats and things like
Matt,
that.
Matt, that's not entirely fair because they put up a new t-shirt today that has a clicker on it and it says Pearl Jam above it. So,
oh, you're right. You
know, like, I'm glad you're all sitting down because that's, you know, that's some big stuff. I know that they might make a sequel one day or another season of the show, but for now they put a band's name on one of the villains from the game.
Maybe we'll get a Pearl Jam t-shirt next year.
But no, you're totally right. Like, and I think that like some people would probably like hear that statement you just made about like the sort of transparency and honesty that game devs have with the audience now and maybe wince at it because there's obviously some examples of that not being the case. But you're 100% correct that like they are constantly setting expectations of what not to expect. Like, even we have to read the code words on every PlayStation showcase and Nintendo Direct. And like, they're like, we're mostly focusing on third party indie software happening between fall and winter of this quarter. And stuff you already know about. And then also PSVR 2. You're like, oh, okay. Thank you. And you're like, so, and it's just that Dumb and Dumber meme where you're like, so you're saying there's a chance, right? And I think a lot of times now, like games launch, like we just noticed it with Payday this week. And same thing with Party Animals, like games launch, they have major server issues. They get review bombed and the devs have to come out and be like, hey, we're working on it. We're sorry. We know we're trying to be honest with you. We're trying to be transparent. Even like with the Unity stuff recently, all those rectangular JPEGs went up with paragraphs in them. Many of them, filled with expletives being like, this sucks for us. Like, I really appreciate that because I feel like that's very different than like, I don't know, the era of PR we grew up in the 90s, where it was like a video game ad that was just like, John Carmack will kick you in the dick, you know, shit like that. What's his name working on Fable being like, if you plant a tree in this game and you come back 3 weeks later,
Peter
like,
Molyneux, yeah. Fruit.
Yeah, yep. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Like there was a lot of that and there'll still be some of that. Like No Man's Sky is still, you know, only a couple of years old. They turned that game around for the most part. Same with Cyberpunk. But like, I do appreciate that happening now. I do appreciate the honesty because I think in 2020, the story was like very nakedly like, hey, our investors at the top of above this company who probably would hold video game controllers upside down in stock photos if asked to, want this game out right now. And I think there was probably a lot of people being like, but it's not ready yet.
Yeah.
Like, sorry, no. Put the game out, you know?
And so, also like, I feel bad because like our job is to talk about this stuff. And if there's problems, we're going to address it, but it's a nuanced issue. And I like, I don't, the devs, they like, you don't make something like this if you don't give a shit, you know, like this is very much like if this game were strictly made for investors, it would probably be more of a Call of Duty clone, but it's still based on a you know, crunchy ass hardcover tabletop player's handbook. And it's, I don't know, it again, like this game probably should have been delayed 3 years. Like it comes down to the investors, and it's hilarious in that sense because like this is a game where you can like generally it's all about like sticking it to the corporations, but then by dropping this game immensely prematurely, like this corporation's kind of stuck it to players a little bit and the like people credit, who made the game, you know?
Right.
Credit where credit is due, right? Like I think there's an alternate future here where if the game company took all the wrong lessons from like the bad days of PR that we alluded to, right? They could have been like, sorry, this is our bad. The game didn't turn out, you know, quite to our standards, but get ready for 2078 where we're promising double the stuff, triple the map, four times the story, five times the excitement, right? And just don't worry about our current game. You can buy it still, but just think about the sequel and pre-order now, right? Like that was the bad version of what they could have done. Instead, they just were like, we're sorry. We know that this game didn't reach your standards. We're going to work on it. Like, for now until the next 3 years to get it to a place that we're happy with and that you will finally enjoy. And they actually did it. And that is like not something that would have happened in the video game industry in like 2002. You know?
No, yeah. No, for sure not. I mean, well, also because like if you shipped like a GameCube disc in 2002, like you couldn't patch it or anything. Right. Like you'd have to mail it back. You know, PS2 games were just like, oh no, it's stuck. But like let's like, you know, let's call this what this is. Like this is absolutely like dedication from the devs. This is a hardworking team of passionate people that turn this game around, but they were only able to do that because this game sold millions of copies in an unfinished state in 2020. And yep. That money directly and those profits directly correlated to a longer lead time on development to fix the game and finally reach the potential of what it had to be. And not a lot of studios are awarded that sort of like level of leniency. Like a lot of them are basically mm-hmm. just like, hey, we ran out of money. We shipped the game, gun to our head, was like, we have to publish the game right now. Like Max and I were talking about in one of our meetings a couple of weeks ago, there was a, I'm forgetting the name of him, but there was a solo dev that worked on like a hand-drawn game for like 4 years. And the publisher just put it out before it was done. And he didn't have any say in it. And it was just like, hey, this sucks. My story is over now. Like, this is not the story I wanted to tell. And like that happened a little bit in 2020 with Cyberpunk, but then the game went on to sell millions and millions of copies, was immensely successful, despite all the problems, despite being delisted on multiple shops. And that money was used to fund the 2.0 update and the expansion, and they turned it all around. And if you're coming in on day one for this game and you get to play it for the first time, then like, man, you're getting an awesome experience. Mm-hmm. But like that experience existed because a lot of people paid for a sort of unfinished product in 2020. Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, if you are just now considering playing this game for the first time, do it. Like it's a great game. In spite of all my dorky ass nitpicks, like it's a phenomenal game, and it's definitely in a state where it is worth playing for sure. No questions asked. You know, assuming you're playing it on a high end PC or a next gen console, that's kind of the big caveat. You can't even play the expansion on last gen, which is an interesting kind of twist, a little wrinkle there. I'm so used to that being the standard where like, oh, if the game came out, it gets DLC on that platform. But I think we're going to see a bit more of that moving forward. Now, I want to talk a little bit about Resident Evil in a second. But before we do that, I want to talk about cyberpunk fiction, media, stuff like that. I'm a huge fan of cyberpunk. I adore it. I inhale it. I've read and watched and consumed so much of it. And playing through Phantom Liberty just reminded me of a bunch of stuff that I love and adore. So I figured I could kind of share that with our viewers and listeners. If you're looking for something to, you know, throw on as an audiobook or something to throw on in the background, here we go. First things first, William Gibson, the so-called godfather of cyberpunk, wonderful science fiction author, a bit crunchy, a bit hard to get into. I highly recommend Burning Chrome, which is a collection of short stories, which contains Johnny Mnemonic, which was then turned into a film. I think it was his first sort of thing in the Neuromancer universe that was published, but cyberpunk borrows so much from this. It's about somebody who's got like a chip stuck in their head. They got data, they got to get rid of it. There's a bunch of other very weird kind of stories in there that I don't think they're all set in the same universe, but it's a similar approach to futuristic storytelling. And it's very cool. Johnny Mnemonic, the movie, is not a perfect movie by any means, but it is a fun watch. The one thing that I believe Phantom Liberty specifically borrows really heavily from this is they have a thing in there called like the pit, which is basically a whole sectioned off city where there's a, you know, the cops don't go there. People don't go there. It's a whole, like, it's its own little enclave. And this movie has that. And I think it's like Ice-T's up there, or Ice Cube. Not Ice Cube. I think it's Ice-T, but I get it mixed up when he's a kangaroo in Tank Girl, which came out, I think, the same year. Anyway, Johnny Mnemonic is cool. Another William Gibson story I love is A Virtual Light, which is, I would say, a lot more accessible than Neuromancer and some of his earlier stuff. This is maybe my favorite of his. In this case, the entire San Francisco Bay Bridge has been basically wrecked by an earthquake. And so people move onto it and create their own city, not unlike Dogtown. And it's pretty much like the kind of thing where, you know, the cops don't go there and the government doesn't mess with it. And people are kind of scared of it. And then it's a bit
Can't imagine that in San Francisco.
Dude, this book is honestly, it is extremely bittersweet to read this while living in the Bay Area in this day and age, because it's got a lot of similarities there. A lot of, you know, low life, high tech, you know, gross disparity between classes and all that. Speaking of which, Neal Stephenson, another phenomenal cyberpunk writer,
He's known very well for Snow Crash, which I highly recommend. The Diamond Age is one that the whole idea of the brain dance stuff in Cyberpunk borrows really heavily from this, where it's people kind of doing like telepresent performances. This one is bizarre because it's very, it's kind of Dickensian. Like, it's almost written like a Charles Dickens story about, like, you know, Tale of Two Cities, that kind of thing, except it's in the extremely cyberpunk future. And there's a bunch of very, very weird stuff going on. Like, a lot of interesting approach to technology. Basically, I think a girl finds like a Hitchhiker's Guide type device. It's like, here's how you survive in the world. Let me help you with everything. And then adventures ensue. But it's a good time. We touched on this for a second, but Escape from New York and Escape from LA. John Carpenter's iconic Snake Plissken must break into New York City, which is now a prison, and rescue the president. That's the premise. Metal Gear Solid borrowed really heavily from this. And I feel like Phantom Liberty does too, but in a really kind of interesting way that almost feels like a simultaneous nod to, you know, the stuff that Metal Gear introduced to games, but also like the story of this and the tone. And, you know, the first one, Escape from New York, is a little bit rough around the edges. It's got some B-movie energy to it. Killer soundtrack, very good. Escape from LA is like kind of the same story and with a lot more 90s attitude. Brian, you mentioned the basketball scene. Kind of a goofy movie, but it's also really fun. It's still very...
It's a blast. It's not as good, obviously, but it's super fun.
Moving on, Dread, a much more recent movie that is just kick-ass. I feel like a lot of gamers have gravitated towards this, and everyone who does always says, it's really good. It's just like The Raid, and it's very much like The Raid, except it's set in a futuristic cyberpunk based on the long-running comic series with Dread, and it's a good time. I really like this movie. It is gnarly as hell. And then finally, if you're into history, check out Kowloon Walled City, which is an actual real-life, or was rather, a cyberpunk enclave in Hong Kong that was just this massive blocks-wide section of buildings that kind of grew together and became this like ungoverned space where it was like ruled by gangs, and like people did their own dentistry, and there was a bunch of drug abuse and prostitution and weird stuff going on, but also a bunch of normal people just lived there. So kind of like Dogtown in that sense. But it's one of those things that just, you know, did exist in our real world that seems like something straight out of Blade Runner or Stray or whatever. But yeah, it's worth looking at. It was demolished in like the early 90s. So there's not really a ton of, you know, high res video of it. And also people weren't about to go crawling around in there with camcorders, but pretty cool. So there you go. Anyway, thank you for coming to my Cyberpunk TED Talk. That's some cool stuff to check out. There's lots more.
Thank you, Max.
You guys want to talk about Resident Evil?
A little nod to Blade Runner at the end there. But yeah, there's a couple of Blade Runner movies you should also watch. They're very good in case you haven't seen them. Resident Evil 4. Wow.
What a game.
Glad I finally got to talk about it on the show. So Resident Evil 4 is, what, 20-something, 19 years old at this point. Got a remake this year. This year has been so good for games that maybe you forgot that. But Capcom did an awesome thing where they decided, hey, we're going to put out that last missing part of Resident Evil 4, Ada Wong's side story, Separate Ways, which was, I believe, originally part of the PS2 version of the game, not on the GameCube version of the game. That was sort of like the, hey, it's coming to PS2. You know, this is what you get for people who want to double dip. You get this extra stuff. And then when the game got ported to Wii and 360 and Wii and everything else, all of that stuff is in one complete package. But when Resident Evil 4 Remake launched this year, it told Leon Kennedy's entire story through this village to save the president's daughter. A lot of, you know, president saving on this episode this week. Everyone was like, this is a fantastic game. You guys went above and beyond on everything. Where's Mercenaries mode? And Capcom's like, give us a few weeks. And they're like, here's Mercenaries mode. And they were like, well, where's Separate Ways? Where's the Ada Wong stuff? And they're like, yeah, we're working on it. No comment. And then recently they were just like, oh, by the way, it's out in a few days. It's done. And oh, P.S., it's $10. And I think some of us were like, $10, huh? Oh, that's interesting for like a 2 or 3 hour game. But, you know, this is them kind of buttoning up all the leftover details on Resident Evil 4, one of the best games of the year. I did an entire video this year about how this is the best video game remake ever made. I stand by that more than ever now. And so I picked up Separate Ways basically the moment it dropped. And which was, it was kind of crappy because like that I had slept like crap the night before and done therapy that morning. I had a long conversation with my therapist about how I need to work on getting 7 or 8 hours of sleep every single night. She's like, this is what you can do to circumvent that. And, you know, here's some breathing exercises and stuff like that. And I was like, wow, thanks. Great notes. Awesome. Then Separate Ways came out at 9 p.m. that night, and I stayed up until like 2 a.m. playing. So sorry, I'll talk to you next week. But what Separate Ways does is, if you've played Resident Evil 4 and you're kind of uninitiated on this, or you need a little refresher, Separate Ways tells Ada Wong's story coinciding with what's happening with Leon S. Kennedy through the events of Resident Evil 4. She's a classic Resident Evil character, and she's been kind of kicking around for a long time. And in this version of the game, she is basically interacting with stuff that you saw Leon do, or going, you know, kind of circumventing or diagonally around environments that you played through already in Resident Evil 4. What's cool about that is that Ada Wong has her own distinct moveset. She's got a grappling hook. She's like a little bit quicker, a little bit more dynamic. Her humor is a lot more dry and less kind of like, she's more sardonic and less campy, I would say. Mm-hmm. And digging into this campaign, it just kept going. Like, it's, I think my playtime doing all of the side missions and everything, you know, the challenges and stuff like that, was somewhere between like 9 and 10 hours, which is crazy because I swear like the original Separate Ways was like 2 or 3 hours, maybe 4 if you did everything. But they added a whole bunch of really cool details here. There's a bunch of like really awesome little nods to Resident Evil canon, like that weird things like Leon Kennedy loses his jacket at one point in Resident Evil 4. It's never actually addressed. It, he's just not wearing mm-hmm. it at one point. And here, like, there's like one of those little merchant challenges where you have to find it, and it's just like one of those little details that I just loved. What's also cool here is they added a whole bunch of new encounters a while back on, and you can see one of them right here, like the full gondola thing has returned. I did a video on Beyond when Resident Evil 4 Remake first came out of, like, you know, obviously gushing with praise over how much I love this game. But, you know, here's a bunch of things that were missing from the remake. One of which was obviously the laser hallway, the U5 boss fight with that weird, you know, kind of like a nasty scorpion man. And then there was the, you know, the whole gondola ride where you're shooting Spanish villagers and they're like, rah, 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 and they're falling down the cliffs and stuff like that. All of that is back here. So like they basically took all of the stuff, all the loose ends that were dangling over from the end of Resident Evil 4, and they threw them in this 9-hour long campaign that has new boss fights, whole new ways to interact, a bunch of new like cool toys to play with, great challenges and stuff like that. And if you play the original game and you did all the, you know, optional challenges that were kind of in the margins, like use a gun a certain amount of times, go through the whole game without beating the merchant. I know Jada like crushed through all of that stuff. I was in a Slack channel with her before the game came out back a couple months ago, and just basically talking about all of this. It's all of that is back here. They added all this new stuff. So like, this is like genuinely, I think, one of the best expansions I've ever seen in gaming, especially for the price. Like for $10 to get a 9-hour story that has multiple difficulty settings, tons of optional side content, tons of optional challenges, and just like all these new cinematics, boss fights, just merchant dialogue. They remixed all the music in the game. Like, it just keeps going. I just love it so, so much. And I'm just really, really happy that this game got the love it deserves from the people who made it, because this game feels like it was made by people who loved the original Resident Evil 4. They made us this special treat this year, and I'm just so happy it's here.
That is Resident so Evil awesome. 4. That is so good to hear, man. I love that it also, like, that is the best case scenario for that, where, you know, you understand there have to be some concessions when you do a massive sprawling remake of what was already a massive sprawling game, and you completely modernize every aspect of it. They're going to have to cut some content. Surprise, it's actually DLC. Like, what a wonderful, like, just a like a psych, like, here it is, enjoy.
It's great. And like PSA on PSN right now, this game is under $40, and so, like, you know, with that and the expansion, you can get the full thing for $50, which is $10 less, and they're selling the iPhone version for
it. Absolutely bonkers.
And it doesn't have touchscreen overlay, and your PS5 probably won't explode when you're playing it, but I digress.
Well, like, moral of the story, great deal. There's two games that just got a huge, massive bunch of updates. They're already good games. They're better games now, and they're weirdly on sale. So that's an option. Folks, thank you for hanging out. Is there anything you want to plug? Jada, anything going on your end?
We've been doing, so I've been pioneering a bunch of new articles for community reviews. We have, you know, users on IGN, you can go and review your favorite games and give them whatever score you think that they deserve. So, you know, you think Resident Evil 4 Separate Ways, I don't know if that's going to be in there, but if you think the Cyberpunk Phantom Liberty, you know, DLC is a 10 out of 10 for you, go to IGN and leave a review there.
Yeah.
Ryan, anything you want to plug?
No, I'm working on a bunch of stuff right now that'll be out soon, but yeah, go play Resident Evil 4.
Sweet. Separate Matt, ways. You got lots of features coming down the chute. What's going on?
Yeah, you know, they're coming, but you know, for everyone else, just check out the Phantom Liberty review that I wrote. I felt like I rambled a bit, but that has all of my thoughts cleanly edited and well written. So,
that's what we do here. We ramble a bit. It happens.
Yeah. And then,
yeah, keep an eye out for the big games of October dropping sometime soon. That's the big monthly video I worked on. They put out too many games in October and I have an issue with it. On that note, thank you all for joining me. It's really nice to have some cool games to talk about, and it's nice to have some cool people to talk about cool games with. Thank you all for watching and listening at home, and we'll see you next week. Beyond.
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 Resident Evil.
Hell yeah. Or...
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.